Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Censored. I'm Aoife Vrednach.
And I'm Lloyd Maeve Houston.
And I have no idea what Lloyd is going to tell me about. I am a lamb to the slaughter.
Jesus.
That's an unfortunate kind of...
Yeah, I was going to say we're doing an episode about the North and we're straight in with the kind of sacrificial violence and bloodshed.
That was not intentional. That was entirely unconscious.
No, the damage is done now. I'm sorry. We're going to have to partition the podcast.
So what are you going to talk about then? Go on. Give us a hint.
I mean, essentially, this is, as sort of adumbrated last time, this is the kind of corresponding episode in our sort of informal two-parter on censorship and its relationship to politics, or at least to the sort of evolving political settlement on the island, and the kind of different forms that censorship takes when you have the island partitioned. Basically, there was not time enough, and there would not be time enough in a single episode to cover what censorship and its relationship with politics becomes in the north of Ireland in the, you know, any time after about 1968. So this is just the sort of, you know, 20s 30s, into the yeah, 20s and 30s, basically.
We could do another one about, you know, troubles. I mean...
Yeah, I imagine we will return to this topic. This is certainly something we could come back to. But yeah, as the kind of initial table setting, basically, we'll talk about what the kind of legal situation is. We'll then talk about what the kind of cinema landscape is. And then we'll look at a couple of examples, one of which, I suppose, is if we are on schedule with the release of this, will be suitably sort of spooky for near Halloween.
Ooh, are we talking about satanic panics? And no, that's the 1960s and 70s, isn't it?
without reifying any stereotypes, when isn't something in the north of Ireland tinged with a shade of satanic panic? You know, the Satan is a kind of a presence in the mindset.
He has a lot of walk-on parts, in fairness.
Yeah, the snares of the devil are all around, and particularly in the picture house. I suppose I'll add a caveat here. I will be fairly freely, just for the sake of my own sanity, toggling between referring to the North, the six counties, Ulster, and Northern Ireland. I'll try to use Northern Ireland specifically when I'm referring to the kind of legal entity, more than, you know, the kind of geographical terrain. Ulster, I guess I'll mostly be invoking kind of as a sort of imagined community that the kind of Northern Irish state is trying to sort of perpetuate, or something that exists particularly maybe in the mindset of the Protestant community, because obviously, confusingly, Ulster, the actual province, historically is 9 counties, but Ulster, as it is understood by Northern Ireland and popularly, you know, especially in British media, is 6 counties. So
we're really sorry, anyone, if this is new to you.
Yeah, if you're not from Ireland, this is Just, I mean, it's like a censored province, you know, it's got three excised bonus spicy border counties.
Wow, that's an image.
It goes without saying that, yeah, the language used to denote the part of the country that I'm from is never not politically inflected. But anyway, so with that proviso in place, the legal regime that sort of determines how censorship operates is basically built on the foundation of the 1909 Cinematograph Act, which required local authorities to license cinemas, principally initially in the interest of public safety. Film stock in this period is highly flammable and is passing over these, you know, what are usually lime lights, which is just like a chunk of lime with like a gas jet on it.
Naked flame.
Yeah. If the film is flowing, you know, at 24 frames a second, it's not going to be in contact with that heat long enough for that to pose a problem. But if there's a jam, as there frequently were, then the whole thing goes up and is all but impossible to put out. Which, when you think that penny cinemas were in, you know, small, like, converted shop fronts and stuff, like, small rooms, usually with a single entrance and exit, usually with the projector by the door. So if you want to get out of the room, you have to run past the thing that is on fire and spewing toxic kind of fumes. So essentially, this initially prompts it, you know, a kind of push to just make cinema safe. But baked into some of the language is this proviso that local authorities can kind of set the conditions for licensing, which can and does come to encompass a set of expectations around, you know, the moral content of cinema and so on. In response to this sort of feeling that some kind of state regulation of cinema might be coming down the pipeline, cinema renters and the kind of film industry in Britain move to institute a regime of self-regulation to try and kind of head that off. And that's where we get what comes to be called the British Board of Film Censors, and eventually the British Board of Film Classification, as it now is, the BBFC. The Home Office are happy to give it the nod because it means that they can make the claim that censorship of films isn't political.
So you can claim that there isn't really censorship. It's industry regulation. So it's not a free speech issue.
Yeah. So it kind of suits all involved. But essentially what that means is that the BBFC become the body to whom you submit a film for cuts. They will make whatever cuts they're going to make, and they will license it under or classify it with either a U label, which is, you know, the one we're all familiar with, Universal, can be shown to anyone, or an A, which is for adults, which confusingly, and it does cause confusion, covers, it means that a film should only be screened to people over the age of 16, or anyone under the age of 16 has to be accompanied by an adult. Eventually, oh,
so children can see it as long as they have adults with them.
Yeah. And then the kind of added special sauce that the North of Ireland brings to the table is the Civil Authorities (parentheses Special Powers Act, Northern Ireland, 1922). Yeah, popularly known as the Special Powers Act, or evocatively as the Flogging Act, which gives you some sense of the. The Flogging Act, which sounds like a text that would be banned by a censorship body.
Absolutely would be, yeah. Yes. They did ban The History of Flogging, very famous book.
It feels incongruous to be laughing this much about something so monstrous. It's a suite of extremely authoritarian emergency powers accorded to the Stormont government, which permitted the Home Affairs Minister to enact any regulation he saw fit to preserve law and order in the province.
Did they flog people?
Well, one of the things that it permits is that, as is often the way with emergency powers, it's introduced on a notionally sort of temporary basis, subject to annual review. So from 1922 until 1928, it is reviewed annually. Then in 1928, it's passed for 5 years, up to 1933. And then in 1933, they're like, ah, Jesus, getting together to debate this thing every 5 years is an arsic. Let's just make it permanent. So Northern Ireland, you know, legally remains in a state of emergency, or, you know, the old state of exception, until 1973, when it is repealed to be replaced by a functionally indistinguishable act as part of it's because of the dissolution of the Stormont government, and Northern Ireland comes under direct rule from Westminster. So in terms of the things it came to sort of encompass, we have good old internment without warrant or trial indefinitely. That is most intensive in the early years of the state. So between 1922 and 1924, about 700 people are interned under these measures, mostly on a ship called the HMS Argenta.
On a ship, a prison ship.
I mean, you know, it wouldn't be like the British state to hold people on boats, you know, as a kind of exorbitant performative measure of punitive cruelty.
Never happened.
There are curfew measures that are permitted under this. There are sweeping powers to ban meetings, parades and marches, and restrictions on the flying of flags. So between 1922 and 1950, about 100 meetings and marches are banned. It won't surprise you to learn that while a few are sort of caught by, you know, kind of universal bans on parades and marches, no loyalist march is ever explicitly banned. It's only ever kind of nationalist, Republican, or occasionally communist sort of gatherings that are targeted. The Home Affairs Minister has the power to forbid inquests if they are deemed a risk to public order. So,
oh no,
yeah, if knowing who did someone in might reflect poorly on the state or some of its members, you just can't. Yeah,
I didn't know about that particular one. That is 100% insanely authoritarian.
Let's just, I mean, look, what's a little bit of state sanctioned murder between friends, you know? Just a bit of extrajudicial slaughter. Sure, that's grand.
Crikey.
And most saliently for our purposes, the power to ban or censor press coverage, publications, audiovisual recordings. So between 1922 and 1972, I think about 140 publications are kind of banned outright. I'm not sure quite what the figures run to on and kind of, you know, film and so on. Violation of these emergency regulations were punishable by up to a year in prison with hard labour, or in quite a few instances, whipping, which is where the flagellation comes in.
Like, they have abolished whipping in the army and the navy.
Yeah.
Which were traditionally the places where you could be guaranteed
rum, sodomy and the lash, right?
Exactly. Now, admittedly, the people serving in colonial branches of the army who are not white are indeed flogged for much longer. There's so many echoes with military stuff, though, because the Mutiny Act, which is the thing that runs the British Army, is an annually renewable act because it's temporary. And technically, the British state doesn't have a standing army. We just, you know, annually spend money on it every year for...
We just enjoy it so much that, you know, the lads keep getting back together. Just love a bit of dress up.
Well, I mean, they do. Let's be honest. That is really one of the main reasons there is an army.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's hard not to sound slightly kind of exorbitant in the rhetoric I'm using to describe this. But the North of Ireland is an extremely militarized state, you know, kind of from the get-go. Any violations of this are adjudicated in closed courts without juries. So, yeah, so summary jurisdiction, obviously.
Obviously.
And even after the Act is repealed, you then have the diplock courts for, you know, trying people again without juries.
I mean, the South does have the Special Criminal Court, so it's not like we are unfamiliar with the concept of we don't need juries for some people.
No, 100%. It's a national pastime.
It's one of those cross-border moments, you know, that would be sweet if it wasn't awful.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
We're going to be hung, drawn and quartered for this.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I look forward to being liberally fact-checked. But, yeah, so, I mean, as you might imagine, the enforcement of the most sort of oppressive elements of this fluctuate depending on the sort of political temperature in the North. So it's most sort of extreme in the sort of 22 to 24 period. Things settled down a bit in 1925. They re-intensified during the IRA border campaigns of the 1950s, and obviously from the onset of, you know, the troubles, most commonly referred to as the Troubles, it's particularly intensive up to the dissolution of the Stormont government. as I say, principally used to target nationalist and Republican kind of communities and activities and the Catholic minority, though it is used to target left-wing and communist groups and publications. So there is this, you know, kind of another cross-border pastime is to really fret about the presence of a communist fifth column that doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
Just godless communism, clearly just waiting to overthrow the state.
Red scares.
Yeah. In contrast to the Free State, which, as we've seen, centres the power to regulate cinema largely in the hands of a single national censor, censorship in Northern Ireland was thus the product of a kind of somewhat convoluted system of interlocking regulation that involved a British non-governmental regulatory body, the BBFC, which provided approved cuts of films for distribution to cinemas who were in turn operating under B licensing conditions set by local authorities, which often had their own bodies for banning and cutting films, the most influential of which is the Belfast Corporation's Complete Police Committee, about whom we'll hear a bit more later, and C, a national set of regulations established by the Minister for Home Affairs, who from 1921 to 1943 is one dude, by the way, Sir Richard Dawson Bates, who is part of, you know, he's great mates with Craig, you know, he helps organise Ulster Day and the signing of the Solemn League and Covenant, sets up the UVF, you know, so a man with the with the concerns of the whole population clearly to the forefront of his mind.
And a broad-minded man, I'm sure.
Oh,
well.
God, yeah. Great crack. Who's operating under the aegis of the Special Powers Act, which, as we've seen, gives him pretty...
As we know, gives him the right to do anything he ever wants, really, at any time.
Do what thou wilt. As Champ Barber notes in her sort of study of the hyper-localism that sometimes characterises the North's approach to censorship, points out this was sort of envisaged by Stormont, at least, as a sort of trickle-down system. So decisions taken in the major urban centres, which had the sort of resources to closely scrutinise the cinema, would then set the template for rural authorities who would follow suit. In practice, the results are way more kind of idiosyncratic than that. Mostly, actually...
Oh, good.
Yeah. We love it. What a surprise. Often, actually, to be honest, more in ways where rural authorities will just take what the BBFC says as kind of rote, and, you know, they won't bother deferring to whatever is, you know, kind of animating Belfast in a given moment. But you also get, you know, things like the decisions of a local authority like Newry, which is, you know, a kind of Catholic majority city close to the border, are going to differ in sort of, you know, temperament to those taken by, you know, more kind of staunchly evangelically Protestant, you know, kind of urban jurisdictions and so on. So that may sound like it's a, you know, challenging environment for which in which a cinema might flourish. But, you know, by the 1930s, particularly, you know, as in the rest of the UK, cinema has become this, you know, the kind of dominant form of popular entertainment. It is vastly popular. The Picture House on Royal Avenue in Belfast hosts the first commercial screening of a talkie, Al Jolson's The Singing Fool, in 1929. And is expanded to become the province's first 3,000-seater super cinema the following year when it's acquired by Paramount.
3,000 people!
Yeah, and I'm assuming that's a single auditorium, which seems madness. Yeah.
I mean, how big is the screen? I just...
I don't know. Yeah, it's, you know, so... Not without reason, Reverend Hunter of the Irish Evangelical Church can be found complaining in 1935, Belfast has gone kinema mad, and craving for this thing is like the craving for alcohol. Yeah, I mean, you know, again, temperance campaigns and, you know, vice policing go hand in hand. But yeah, by 1936, there's about 100 permanent cinemas in the six counties. And as John Hill note in what is, you know, to some extent the sort of the book on cinema in Northern Ireland, not least because it's called that, just as Catholicism in the South could be seen to be demanding the censorship of films in order to preserve the moral purity of the Irish nation, so popular Protestantism in the North fought for increased regulation of the cinema and censorship in order to preserve what it regarded as the special moral and political character of the Northern state. And as he points out, this can lead to a sort of paradoxical situation where strident unionists are kind of pushing back against the moral climate of Britain in order to preserve some, like, higher species of true Britishness. So,
because everybody on the island of Ireland is special.
Well, North yeah, I mean, the exceptionalism is rife. Although, again, Sian Barber offers a certain degree of qualification here, sort of saying that, yes, this accounts for some elements of this, but that kind of increased regulation never really took on a coherent singular form, right? So it does vary, you know, place to place. And Protestantism isn't necessarily always the kind of determinant at a particular moment. But yeah, so what this results in is a kind of climate in which, as the Belfast Newsletter put it, commenting on a 1930 tourist film entitled Ulster, The Garden of Eden, which already kind of tells you everything you need to know about the way that Ulster is framing itself in this period.
That's a some bold claim.
Yeah,
there.
Right. we are.
But does that mean everybody's naked?
I somehow imagine not. I mean, as a famous mural, I can't remember quite where in Belfast puts it, you know, no topless bathing. Ulster has suffered enough. But yeah, according to this, you know, sort of Belfast Newsletter commentator, based on this film's presentation of it, Ulster was only ever to be shown as a place where nothing stronger than curds and whey was ever sold in hotel bars on Sunday, where the youth of the country motored miles for simple Bible instruction at Antrim, and where turf sportsmen and Sunday golfers tumbled over each other in a mad scramble to be early and often at church.
I mean, wow.
Yeah, but yeah, so I mean, we see that kind of, you know, Protestant push to regulate cinema coming through in things like, in a classic move, moral panic about a piece of legislation that doesn't actually affect the North. So the 1932 Sunday Entertainment Act, which, as it suggests, permitted limited film screenings on Sundays, wasn't going to be extended to the North of Ireland, or wasn't, it you know, didn't cover it. Nevertheless, a lot of church groups get very animated about this. Mm. And, you know, the desire to preserve the sort of Ulster Sunday becomes a big kind of clarion cry. There's also efforts to, like, prevent the building of new cinemas near places of worship, which are fairly successful throughout the sort of 1930s.
How? I'm sorry, but there are a lot of places of worship in Northern Ireland. Like,
I was going to say, every, like, put it this way, I grew up in a town that is, like, a small town that had maybe, I'm going to say conservatively, six churches of different denominations.
Like, if you can't have a cinema near any of them, where is left in the town to put your cinema apart from some field out the back?
Yeah, so, you know, there is that kind of push to hold cinema, at a literal arm's length. And, you know, you even get people at, like, the general synod of the Church of Ireland sort of being like, the situation across the border is preferable. You know, it's one of the rare things that people in the North are quite vocally like, no, the South have the right approach to this. The most concerted sort of manifestation of this is the Film Committee of the Churches in Northern Ireland, which is established in 1930. Unsurprisingly, the churches in question are all Protestant. Weirdly, the Catholic Church, I mean, you know, obviously they're not exactly liberal and permissive, but they're, I think maybe they have bigger things to worry about than cinema.
They don't do plural either, churches, no. It's just the church.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Sorry. But Yeah, so they come to the Belfast Corporation with a set of recommendations, including things like, you know, banning all children under 16 from films and stuff, and or films with an A certificate, I think. And partly to kind of mollify them, they are given free entry to Belfast cinemas and granted permission to liaise with the police committee, who would investigate any film that they deem unsuitable. And they pursue this with all the zeal you would expect. So to eventually, after a lot of runway being laid, to get to our first film, the first film that they recommend for scrutiny in this manner is Universal Pictures' 1931 adaptation of Frankenstein, which, you know, if you think about like the stereotypical Frankenstein, you know, bolts through the neck, big blunt, you know, top of his head, lumbering gait, groaning, etc. Like, it, you know, it's alive, it's alive. The thing that proves certainly most concerning to the people of the north of Ireland when they are confronted with this film, or when the prospect of the film emerges, is the kind of grave robbing and the, you know, arrogating unto himself the power of God in making life that Frankenstein, you know, undertakes. And to be fair to our panicked Nordies, those things are heavily stressed. Like, the film is all in on that. So, you know, it opens on a funeral that is like kind of gleefully being observed by Fritz, who is the figure that we always misremember as being called Igor, but, you know, the kind of like hunchback, you know, sort of assistant. He and Frankenstein are watching this sort of burial, and the instant the earth is kind of set over this body, they're straight in digging him up. And there are various different points, you know, where Frankenstein very much declares himself to, like, you know, now I know what it is to be God. So they stress this pretty heavily. Although, also, to be fair to the film, they have, in clearly a move that's meant to anticipate the problem, they have one of the characters, like Frankenstein's sort of mentor figure, come out before the film begins to be like, here's the summary of the plot. Like, you know, Frankenstein believes him, you know, he arrogantly assumes the power of a god and is punished. Like, explicitly says, this is a parable about playing God and why that's bad.
So they don't even leave it to the interpretation of the audience. They're like, this is why we are telling you this. It's a morality tale.
Yeah.
Pay attention.
I mean, it's a little more playful than that. There's a kind of sense of like, we hope you don't find it too spooky. I'd never seen it before criminally, but like parts of it do, I think, really do hold up. Like, they're, it gets stronger as it goes along. But by the time Frankenstein, like, himself gets thrown from the windmill and lands on its blade in another pretty kind of, ooh, yeah. It's, I mean, you know, the dummy's pretty dummy, but it's, yeah. Also, oh, like, Fritz gets hanged. The monster, like, hangs Fritz by chain, and we see him sort of, you know, dangling there. It strangles the Dr. Waldman, the kind of mentor figure. So, you know, it's pretty gruesome. It doesn't certainly pull its punches where, you know, threat and violence are concerned. But yeah, it's ultimately passed in the US and Britain, where, you know, it is controversial with church and morality groups. The BBFC insist on 300 feet, or roughly 7 minutes of cuts. And kind of, unfortunately, we will never see the full film as it was made, because those cuts were made to the negative. So the version of Frankenstein we have is already a sort of censored one, but it's passed with an A rating. So, you know, children under 16 accompanied by an adult, adults can go see it. Interestingly, it's passed in the south of Ireland over the objections of Montgomery. So he's like, this will cause the mentally vulnerable to go crazy, is basically his fear. But the appeals board are like, nah, it's fine. So it's passed with cuts there. But yeah, the film committee of the Churches of Northern Ireland, clearly ready and raring for this film to come out. They formally object to it on the day it's first screened in Belfast. Wow. So on the 19th of April 1932, they're straight in there. The police committee arrange a special screening of the film the following day and ban it on the grounds that it was blasphemous and unedifying. However, the situation is complicated when Universal Pictures appeal the ban, because only 5 members of the police committee attended the screening and only 3 voted in favour of the ban. So that, combined with press criticism, prompts the police committee to arrange a second screening, to which it invites members of the Belfast City Council, the Northern Ireland House of Commons and Senate, and then follow it with a full kind of council debate after the screening. The most vocal opponent of the ban is a member of the Northern Ireland Labour Party. But in the end, after an hour and a half's debate with apparently a sort of packed public gallery, the supporters of the ban carry the day by a small majority. So, you know, there's lots of people kind of waxing lyrical about the, you know, the immorality of vitalising a corpse and the effects that the black art of the monster's creation might have on the immature brain and so on.
I mean, OK.
Well, what's really funny about this, again, with my, you know, kind of my special interest hat on, like the film is made with this kind of quite Lombrosian, like degenerationist sense of like, you know, there being kind of degenerate minds that are dangerous. So the reason that the monster is prone to violence potentially is because there's a point where, you know, they've assembled the body, but they need a brain. And Dr. Waldman is giving this, you know, lecture on cerebration, and, you know, he has these two brains in jars, and he's like, a normal brain, the most perfect specimen that I have ever seen in, you know, in this university, and the abnormal brain of the criminal, you know, this degenerate and underdeveloped mind. And so, so, you know,
does Fritz take the wrong one?
Fritz, no, it's even better than that. Fritz goes in and fair play to him, he goes for the normal brain, he goes for the good specimen, but then there's like a kind of noise off that shocks him and he drops it. And then he picks up the other brain and is like, shit, 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 and scampers off. So, yeah, the monster winds up with bad brain, and, you know, but also, like, everyone just keeps waving flaming brands in its face and chaining it up. And, like, you know, I wouldn't be terribly well disposed to people doing this to me. But, yeah, so, you know, a film that is clearly concerned with the idea that, like, there are, you know, neurological predispositions toward crime that can be actualized by, you know, sort of bad nurture, is, you know, begets this moral panic about the effect that this film will have on the kind of vulnerable minds. But back to the kind of hyperlocalism thing, that's the case in Belfast, but in Lisburn, the picture house there runs three screenings a day of the film to packed houses. So, you know, just get on a train.
Go down the road, day out.
Yeah, you're fine. You can see it. You know, the thing is a huge financial success for Universal. Also, students at Queen's University mock the decision as part of their sort of Rag Week celebrations. So they parade a replica Frankenstein's monster through Belfast and then drop it from a crane into the Lagan.
Go away, that's brilliant.
To the strains of the funeral march being played by the Pro Tanto Quid Band, spelt B-A-N-N-E-D. Which is, it's a bit sweaty, but I appreciate it, lads. Yeah, so
very good.
So that's Frankenstein in 1932. So that's you know, our kind of evangelical Protestant anxiety about, you know, things ungodly. Unsurprisingly, the other thing in this period that provokes real issues are films that depict the Troubles, i.e., the, you know, the War of Independence,
1920s
yeah,
Troubles.
The sequence of political unrest that is initiated by the Easter Rising and culminates in the War of Independence into the Civil War. And this is a concern, and even outside of Ireland, the BBFC liaises with the MPPDA to pre-vet films depicting the Troubles.
Okay.
So the main film I'm going to be talking about is a movie that in Britain and Ireland is called Ourselves Alone, but in America is called Rivers of Unrest. I'm not sure where the rivers come from. There's nothing terribly fluvial about the film, but, you know.
It rhymes, though, so it sounds
yeah,
good.
Yeah, you know, the alliteration is nice and present. I mean, I suppose, you know, I do understand that obviously there's going to be segments of a population, particularly an American population, won't know what the referent of Ourselves Alone is. But yeah, interesting naming choice. But this film, so it's kind of made and pre-vetted with input from the BBFC to ensure that it's not too politically contentious. But even with that, it goes on to be politically contentious. So to be fair, I was really gripped by it. This one is it's worth a watch. I think it's a really interesting example of like British cinema in this sort of period. It's again adapted from a play and seemed to be, well, it was well liked in some circles. So it was voted the seventh best British film of 1936 by The Examiner, and the Irish Times sort of in an article on the films of the year were like, you know, if there were a bet on for this, you know, I would take a flutter on Ourselves Alone. So the, you know, it plays well, admittedly, in the Irish Times, which is not necessarily, you know, uniformly reflective of opinion in the South, but Graham Greene doesn't like it. So he's the film reviewer for the Spectator, and he says that it's the silliest thing he's ever seen. the silliest thing that a British, you know, production house has ever made.
Silly? That's an unusual criticism.
Well, you'll potentially see where he's coming from. It's a film that very interestingly combines what feels like a real push for authenticity in terms of observation of like details of uniform and like the classification of the different aspects of the British Army that are involved and so on, but that has quite a silly kind of plot in terms of like who turns out to be who and whatnot. As concisely as I can summarize it, it opens with an Irish Republican attack on a British military convoy that's transporting prisoners. So there's two fellas from higher-ups from Dublin who are being held, and they're being transported in a lorry driven by Private Parsley, who becomes a kind of recurring common relief. Yeah, Private Parsley, a recurring comic relief figure who, you know, a bit like Gunner, who gets, you know, massacred in the plane in A Yank Joins the Aria. Yeah, we've got another kind of Cockney who's like, oh, blimey, governor! who's perpetually just kind of, you know, concerned with how people are mistreating the various vehicles he has to drive. Anyway, he is left, you know, they launch this sort of surprise attack that's meant to lure as many of the British guards away from the vehicle as possible so that the real attack can happen. We then kind of follow the aftermath of this through the eyes of John Hannay, who's the county inspector for the RIC, in a rather fetching RIC uniform, like very, you know, cut to the waist, back to the pretty, you know, pretty boys in uniform.
Phrases I never thought I would hear. Fetching RIC uniform.
The man has a good frame, and they really, it's very cinched. He is snatched. He is, you know, it's a look.
Good.
So he is liaising with a British intelligence, like army intelligence kind of officer, who promises him intel from an informer that'll help, you know, kind of crack this. Well, you know, he basically says, like, I have information coming about, you know, a meeting that's taking place tonight that will allow you to get your prisoners back and round up all the kind of leadership of this and finally get that Mick O'Day fella. And
is this actually Michael Collins, do you think? A mysterious figure who's called
Mick. Yeah, it's, yeah, there's, you know, one of the commandants is Commandant Connolly. You know, it's, yeah, it's kind of playing with this stuff. Although you'll be interested who the Collins figure turns out to be, to some extent. Basically, in the midst of sanctioning that operation or that raid, the RIC county inspector guy is like, also, can someone go check on my fiance? She's, you know, Maureen, up in the big house. So she's,
oh,
you know,
no.
Anglo-Irish woman, which means English woman. She is just, there's no attempt here made at an Irish accent whatever, which, to be honest, I'm glad of, compared to some of the Irish accents that you hear in some of the other films I watched for this. But you know, so she's just very much waiting for her fiance. It's also clear that like there's a lot of chemistry between her and this British intelligence guy, you know.
Oh, I see, a little bit of flirting on the side.
Yeah, he kind of puts the moves on her. We're basically primed to see the RIC guy is a bit like short-tempered, but you know, he'll come good in the end, of course. And he, after this encounter, Maureen then catches her brother going out in, you know, dressed up in a trench coat, looking kind of mysterious. It's notionally meant to be a night fishing trip.
In attempting to slip some
cake into his pocket. Again, extremely English man. Terence Elliot, or whatever his name is, you know, deeply English guy. But in attempting to slip some cake into his pocket, she finds she feels a revolver in there, and she's like, oh, you know, are you messing around with those Republican? Meanwhile, there's also a quite significant conversation where a new recruit to the RIC asks the intelligence officer guy, like, oh, you know, can you give me some tips on how to survive this whole guerrilla war thing that we've got going on? And he's
what a question.
Yeah, he's like implausibly kind of naive, but it's meant to, you know, kind of engineer a bit of sympathy for him. So yeah, so this implausibly naive and kind of, you know, very butter wouldn't melt in his mouth English guy asks for advice, and he's told, you know, shoot first and ask questions afterwards. Trust no one, don't talk, and remember, never take your hand off your gun. Sinn Féin, you know what that means? Ourselves alone. They're all watching you, whispering and spying, murdering and informing. Sinn Féin, that ought to be our motto, not theirs. We're the ones who are really alone. So, you know, it's...
Wow.
In places it goes pretty hard in its, you know, kind of... We're the real victims of of colonial rule in Ireland. But to be fair, you do also have moments like earlier in the film that, you know, there's a whole fucking pub scene with lots of singing, women hiding guns down their garters, the singer kind of taking up a collection of all the guns because the British are coming and putting them all in the beer keg and stuff. You know, so... There is airtime given to nationalist sentiment. Anyway, sorry, there's a lot of plot. And eventually, to try and cut a long story short, Mick O'Day is found. And you'll never guess who Mick O'Day turns out to be.
Is it the brother of the big house girl?
Yeah, it's our extremely English Terry. He turns out to be big man Mick O'Day, and who has like tried to exercise, you know, a sort of a sense of fair play and caution in the trying of this informant. He says, you know, I'm not going to just execute a man on report. You know, we need to, you know, see that justice is done here. So basically, the more English you sound, the more sound you are in the logic of this film.
Yeah, the fairer you are as an insurgent if you have a cut glass English accent.
Yeah, the thick Dublin accent people, they're all just like, ah, sure, kill anyone, organise a big, you know what the best way to take out army convoys is? Do it in town where you'll hit as many civilians as possible. And, you know, Terry is like, no, one couldn't possibly, you know, as long as we're in my territory, we'll conduct ambushes as I determine them. Gala. But when he is captured,
this is a bit of a head fuck.
Yeah, you see where Graham Greene's coming from with some of the kind of like, this film is quite silly. So he is detained, and he and John Hanney, you know, this local county inspector of the RIC who is betrothed to his sister, they have this conversation, which again, to be fair to the film, is genuinely pretty balanced in terms of, you know, each of them calling out the other for their recourse to exorbitant violence and sort of saying, well, you know, but it's justified, but, you know, it's justified by our cause or whatever. And then, you know, the county inspector guy is like, you know, why are we all so seized with hate? And Terry, in impeccable English accent, you know, received pronunciation, is like, no, I am motivated by love. I love Ireland and I love all that she could be. And... you know, I sometimes feel sorry for you, John. And he's like, I'm as Irish as you are. And he's like, yes, but you do not, you know, you act against Ireland.
Feel the love.
Yeah. So, you know, to be fair, through the admittedly kind of sanitized mouthpiece of this very English, Anglo-Irish person, we get, you know, this sense that, you know, that there is a respect, at least a kind of moral version of nationalism that could be envisaged or something. But we also get someone in the RIC saying, I'm as Irish as you are, you know. So it's when it needs to be, it's fairly nuanced. But anyway, in the midst of this conversation, Terry jumps out a window and runs away. So O'Day is, you know, making a break for it. The army intelligence officer shoulders a rifle and is like, I'll get him when he's in the searchlight, pops him. But at the same time, your man, the county inspector guy, is at the window with a pistol that we know is jammed, but also kind of points it. So basically, by the end of this thing, when all's said and done, Maureen learns that the fella she actually fancies has murdered her brother, who she finds out is actually O'Day. The county inspector guy sees that they are clearly made for each other and does the kind of honourable thing of simultaneously asking her to break the engagement and taking responsibility for shooting the brother, Yeah, and...
Wow. Self-sacrificial. Very noble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm turning through pages of notes. There's so much fucking plot. So, yeah, his kind of subaltern says to him, you know, men aren't killed by guns that are jammed, County. You're a damned fine man, John Henney. And, you know, and the film concludes with our, you know, now kind of redeemed sort of guy saying to camera, you've seen a miracle in Ireland, two people out of three who are going to be happy. And, you know, look sort of somewhat plangently and stoically off into the distance.
I'm sorry, what? Two people out of three happy is a miracle.
You know, from a kind of like Irish studies standpoint or like cultural representations of Ireland, obviously, while there is lip service paid to like, oh, you know, there's valour being shown on both sides. Fundamentally, the film is like, Ireland is a turbulent and ungovernable place in which, like, everyone is on the make. The only decent people are basically English. So, you know, the best you can hope for is a situation in which two out of three people are happy about something.
And, you know, preferably the story ends happily if the IRA men are shot, really.
That's... Well, to be fair, they actually, they seem to make a getaway. We don't see what
oh,
happens.
Oh, the two Dublin lads.
Yeah, it's the honourable Mick O'Day who is tragically sort of sacrificed. It's the hardliners who you can imagine going off to, you know, start the Civil War, I guess, if we follow the sort of analogy here.
Yeah.
They get off scot-free. Things are redeemed by a union emerging between a British Army intelligence officer and this, you know, Anglo-Irish woman being sanctioned by an RIC man who has like reconciled the conflicting elements of his duty. So, you know, the whole thing is ultimately pretty uncomplicatedly kind of unionist in outlook, let's say, or premised upon, you know, the sort of the triumph of a set of like British noble virtues. But notwithstanding all of that nuance and exorbitant plot, you know, notwithstanding all of this sort of pro-union-y sort of stuff, right, the film pays enough lip service to just the existence of trouble at all and that there might be any right, I suppose, on the kind of nationalist side of the equation that, notwithstanding the BBFC passing it, the film becomes a real source of sort of trouble or a concern in the North. A sense of like the kind of controversy that attaches to the film, we can kind of capture in the intervention of a unionist MP, William Grant, in the Northern Ireland House of Commons, where in speaking on the need for maintaining law and order in Northern Ireland, he reported that he'd attended a private screening of the film that morning and said, I do not wish to be taken as an alarmist or anything of that kind, which, you know, says every alarmist.
But.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm of the opinion that if that picture is shown in Belfast next week, it may tend to create trouble in the city. I know that the Belfast Corporation is the local authority responsible for dealing with the matter, but at the same time, I think some steps should be taken by the Ministry of Home Affairs in conjunction with the local authority. They should attend a private view of this picture before it is exhibited in the public next week. If they are satisfied that the picture would not tend to create a disturbance in the city of Belfast, I am perfectly satisfied. I do not want to suggest for a moment there is anything wrong, but I do feel that this picture is purely Sinn Féin propaganda and some action should be taken.
I'm not saying it's problematic, but it's fucking awful.
It's just purely Sinn Féin propaganda, and if you show it, there will be a riot. So we, you know, this suggestion is followed. There's a screening attended by people like Dalton Bates, the Inspector General of the RUC, the Belfast City Commissioner, various kind of members of the Home Office, and it's banned, you know, and that's kind of under the emergency powers.
Oh, so that's different to the Belfast Police Committee. This is the Home Office. This is the minister in Stormont banning it.
Yes. Okay, yeah, sorry. It's just kind of outright prohibited, which actually then kind of leads to a bit of sort of pushback or at least queries from the Home Office sort of being like, well, the BBFC, we're fine with this. Like, what's the issue? And you know, Dalton Bates is kind of like, no, like, the situation here is different. And
it's always the situation up north, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always the situation. situation.
I just wanted you to say that. Thank you for humouring
me. You hear this, listeners?
Is this Nordy baiting? I think
sort of bear baiting that goes on. And this sets in motion a sort of pattern where a succession of similar films, including John Ford's The Informer in 1935, or which isn't screened until, or isn't attempted to be screened until sort of 36, and also his adaptation of The Plough and the Stars, which is, again, talk about a butchering of a source text, like it's mad. But yeah, I mean, there's also the paradox to all this that obviously would any of these films been as controversial as they proved to be had the state not drawn attention to them in this manner? Who's to say?
Yeah, if people don't know and aren't primed to expect that their feelings will be hurt, then maybe they won't take offence.
Are people less likely to riot about something if they haven't been told that they might riot, you know?
That's another cross-border moment, though, you know, given out in the cinema and rioting and...
And objecting to The Plough and the Stars as well, right? Like, there's something very, very funny about a play that was rioted about because it was too anti-nationalist, then being kind of rioted about for being too nationalist when it's screened in the north of Ireland. Having just said, you know, oh, what a... How awful that that British film suggested that this island is ungovernably kind of complicated and self-contradictory, you know...
Yeah, but it's different when we say it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, it's like your family, right? Like, you know, you can criticize your family. No one else can criticize your family, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so here endeth, at least for now, a rather exorbitant account of cinema censorship in the north of Ireland. Yeah, so thank you for following... any of that, if it was indeed followable.
No, I did learn a lot. I learned that there's a flogging act, and I'm kind of blown away by the extent of the emergency power. Yeah, wow. That's some level of emergency.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, look, if you take nothing else away from this, listeners, just learn that any extrajudicial legislative measures kind of enacted under the insignia emergency, usually bad.
And temporary, almost never temporary.
As Walter Benjamin tells us, you know, the state of exception isn't exceptional, it's the norm, and it's how the state works. Geez, sorry, I've gone full, like, kind of... you know, guerrilla anarchist this episode. Anyway, look forward to the next episode being recorded from my bunker.